Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee and you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly.
When it comes to style and luxury, eBay gets it. They're making sure the things that you love are checked by experts. Not just any experts, specialized experts. Real people who love this stuff with real hands-on authentication experience.
So when you see that shiny blue checkmark that says Authenticity Guarantee, shop with confidence. Every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is verified authentic through a detailed inspection. That's how you know that eBay's got your back.
Because when you finally step into those sneakers, put on that watch, get your real gold glow up, swing that handbag over your shoulder, or step out in that streetwear, you'll realize that feeling is unlike any other.
With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms. Jen, this is a special episode of Fat Mascara.
It's very special.
Actually, it is a panel that I hosted a couple weeks ago called Bad Beauty. It was at the Strand Bookstore.
I was there taking photos like a proud mom.
Jess was supportive in the back row, absolutely. But it was a couple of authors, and we talked about what it's like to write about beauty in a post-Lena Dunham world. So it's Georgia Clark, Phoebe Robinson from the podcast So Many White Guys, Emily Schultz, and Autumn Whitefield Medrano.
Who was on the podcast, and you guys really liked that.
Yeah.
That one did really well.
Yeah, that was a good episode. So this is us doing the panel. We apologize in advance if the sound isn't that great. We weren't in the studio, but we hope you enjoy it.
We wanted you to be there, so this is our way.
I'm really psyched to have a terrific panel of fantastic writers here tonight to discuss the ways that appearance shapes identity, that beauty standards or the beauty standards that we challenge and live by every day, and how we talk and write about the ways we look, all in celebration of Georgia Clark's recently released novel, The Regulars. Joining Georgia tonight on the panel are comedian, writer, and one of the rock stars behind the podcast, Two Dope Queens, Phoebe Robinson, author, podcast, and co-founder of Joylin Magazine, Emily Schultz, journalist and face value author, Autumn Whitefield Medrano, and finally, as moderator, Jennifer Goldstein, beauty editor at Marie Claire and co-host of the Fat Mascara podcast. Please join me in welcoming these magnificent women to Strand.
Yes, I just cheered for myself.
Hi, guys. Welcome to Bad Beauty. We decided to have a beauty panel on the ugliest day of the year and the ugliest month of the year. But here we are to talk about beauty and what it means to us, beauty standards, and everything going on today. I'm going to let the women here introduce themselves so you can know what their books are about and why the hell they belong on this panel in the first place. Phoebe, why don't you start?
Yes, so my book is coming out October 4th, and it's called You Can't Touch My Hair. And other things I still have to explain. And it's an essay collection about race, gender, pop culture stuff. Some personal stories from my life, my obsession with like Michael Fassbender and U2. There's a lot happening in this book. And it was super fun to write. It's my first book. I'm very excited. And hopefully you guys will read it.
It comes out in
October 4th.
Got it.
So it's a little ways away.
put it on your list?
My name's Georgia Clark. My book, The Regulars, came out a couple of weeks ago. It has a beautiful pink cover. I see some people holding it. And it's about three young women living in Brooklyn who get their hands on something called Pretty, which turns you into your ideal physical self for 1 week at a time. So it deals pretty explicitly with the allure and idea of beauty, the upsides and the downsides.
My name's Emily Schultz, and my recent novel is called The Blondes. It's newish, and what it is it's about a rabies-like virus that makes women, blonde women, natural or dyed, rage out. And I wrote it because I felt like people aren't afraid enough of women, and maybe they should be, and we should get angry because there's a lot of shit going on.
Amen. My name is Autumn White from Madrano. I'm the author of Face Value, The Hidden Ways Beauty Shapes Women's Lives. And it looks at sort of the generation of women who came of age after the ideas and the beauty myth were floating around out there. And what I found was that there was a lot of complex and contradictory attitudes toward beauty, which is why I'm really excited for this panel.
Yeah, that brings up the point of the panel, which is the beauty standard. When I first heard that word, I was like, is there still a beauty standard? And we talked about this a bit, and we sort of agreed there is. So, Georgia, since you are the reason we are here, what is the beauty standard you sort of grew up with and you've been holding yourself up to, and do you think it's still around?
Well, the beauty standard that I kind of looked to explore in the fiction of The Regulars was, and the way the Pretty works on the girls is this sort of homogenous way in which it kind of makes them sort of thinner, more toned, like lustrous hair, clear skin, like sort of proportioned, like ass and boobs. So, in a way that kind of cuts across a lot of different sort of ideas of what we think beauty is. I think it's such an interesting question, because I think the beauty standard is something that changes within whatever kind of tribe you're in, and that we all, in this kind of day and age, I don't think that we're all just sort of these slaves to Maybelline ads, and we are expressing ourselves through the ways that we present ourselves, but at the same time, I'm just sort of interested in the parameters of choice with it, like, if we all just stopped grooming ourselves, you know, would we still be as powerful as we want to be? You know, that's sort of a question I'm interested in. So I definitely think that beauty standards exist in a very kind of commercial mainstream sense and within sort of like the communities that I sort of see here in this room. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what I was interested in exploring in The Regulars.
Phoebe, if we talk about the beauty tribe and living up to the beauty standard in a beauty tribe, did you have any beauty standard you tried to live up to growing up, or do you now?
Yeah, I think being a woman of color in America is like, gay, okay. Just because most things are not, you're very much reminded that, hey, you don't look like what, I don't look like Jennifer Aniston. Like, I will never look like her, and that's totally fine by me. But, it does, you feel like there's a lot of Eurocentric stuff that's happening. You don't fit within that. And in my book, I have this essay where I talk about my hair journey and how I used to perm my hair. This is a weave because I can't deal with my fro in the summer. It's too much of a thing. Black people know, they're nodding. it's a lot of work, so I'll wear weaves in summer. But yeah, I talk about my hair journey, how I went from like straightening my hair and like the conditioning of that, because I mean, my mom started straightening my hair when I was like 5 or 6 years old, and then I was perming my hair for a while and really damaged my hair. I just went through all the feels of like, you know, learning what my identity is and why it was so tied to having my hair straightened and not natural, and like how I perceive myself as pretty or not pretty based on my hair, and how societal pressure puts a lot on women, on black women in particular, where people just think like, oh, black women just love spending tons of money on their hair because they're just like careless and they're frivolous. And it's like, for black women in particular, it's a very, that's like the first thing that people see about you. Yeah. And people literally decide who you are based on what your hair means to them. And so when we're spending this money on our hair, it is not just because we just want to blow hundreds of dollars. It's really like, this will affect what kind of jobs I get. This will affect like what kind of dates I get asked at all. And so there's all these factors that go into it. And then like makeup, and I live in Brooklyn, and even living in Brooklyn, it's hard.
It's a tribe. Brooklyn's a tribe.
It's hard for me to find foundations sometimes. I'm like, okay, this is annoying.
If you can't find it in Brooklyn, like where?
Yeah. So there's a lot to it, and it's.
So
it,
you do feel there is still a standard,
oh,
and you're striving for it.
For sure, for sure. But I feel like I'm just pretty much like, I'm just gonna do me. I'm 31. I don't give a shit anymore. I really don't. I just don't. It's like, whatever.
People do evolve as they get older. Emily, your book actually talks about hair quite a bit. The standard.
I'm very excited to read Phoebe's as soon as it comes out because I'm obviously obsessed with hair. And I had a lot of hair issues growing up for a white girl, which is that my hair is quite coarse and curly, and I always tried to straighten it. My parents kept it short. My parents were very practical, Midwestern types. My mother would never call herself feminist, but, you know, they were coming out of the hippie era, and the idea of doing anything, makeup, hair, nail polish, like, I really didn't do it when I was growing up because I really wasn't allowed. It was just frowned upon. They were very practical people. And so I have a complex relationship to beauty, which is that I was kind of a tomboy, and I was kind of raised in this natural setting where you don't do this stuff, because why would you? Because it's just dumb. And then at the same time, you know, as I got older, you know, into adolescence, I was exploring that more. And that was, for me, a kind of rebellion, I think, was, you know, to embrace anything that was super feminine, because I was, you know, dressing in my brother's clothes and wearing short hair my whole life. But so I've always had a very complicated relationship with my hair and whether or not to grow it, whether or not to cut it. Right now, I mean, I was just here doing an event at the Strand about 2 months ago. I don't know if anyone was at the Bad Women event, but at that point, my hair was much darker. I've let it go silver. So that's my struggle now, is whether or not I'm going to let it silver. But
I love the fact that, like, all of you have so much to say about this. When you think, like, it seems superficial. It's just what we look like, but it does mean so much to us.
It's Autumn, definitely not superficial.
Yeah, it's not, though. It's not. And Autumn, in your book, you talk about not so much a beauty standard, but a beauty imperative. Can you explain what that means and what you really are trying to say with that?
Yeah, in interviewing women for the book, I found that, as Georgia points out, like, there's not necessarily this, there's no longer one beauty standard. There's a lot of different beauty standards. But the thing that all those standards have in common is that you have to meet them, or you have to appear to be trying to meet them. So the idea is, like, you can have whatever standard you want, boho girl or Upper East Side princess, but whatever it is, it's imperative that you meet it, and that you look like you're trying to meet it. And so, like, there's just that constriction that women face is what I found was more in common, rather than everyone striving for this once upon a time beauty standard that maybe was a little more common, like, say, 30 years ago.
And do you think men have their same kind of standard like that?
I think men definitely, they face pressures, of course, to look a certain way, and I think that that's increasing on men. But as far as, like, the beauty imperative, no, like, men can look like shit, and, like, no, everyone's got, like, we talked about Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Like, remember when Hillary Clinton, she was Secretary of State, she showed up to a breakfast meeting with no makeup, and media people freaked out. Feminists were like, that's awesome, and people were like, why is she doing that? That's unprofessional. Can you imagine if she'd shown up to the Democratic primary debates looking like Bernie Sanders with, like, her hair all over the place? Like, she would have been, you know, hounded down. So the idea is you still have to look a certain way. Like, whatever way you're trying to look, that might vary, but it's imperative that you do
find
it.
Fine, there is still one. Yeah. So as you guys were writing your books, you have different types of books here. We have, a memoir, fiction, nonfiction. Did you find your beauty standard evolving? Like, Phoebe, as you were writing about your hair, or about, you talk to your, I think it's your niece in your book.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Did you find yourself learning new things about, you know, and wanting to move beyond this standard?
I mean, I guess it's kind of easier for me to, like, move beyond the standard, because the standard in America is a white woman, and I'm not white, so I'm already out.
You're just like, fuck it.
You know,
moving
I'm already
on.
Yeah. So for me, it was just more like me, like, looking back on my journey to, like, where I am now, and, like, having a 2-year-old niece. She's biracial, and she's going to face certain challenges too. But she might also get certain advantages because she's very light-skinned. And so if you, like, saw her just, like, in passing, you go, oh, that's, like, a little white girl. So, you know, I think what she's going to go through is going to be markedly different than what I go through.
Right.
So it's just more of me just kind of being, like, giving her, like, whatever advice I can based on my time on the planet.
Sure.
But, yeah, I don't know. I feel like I've gotten to a place where I mostly accept the way that I look. I mean, I will always be insecure that my boobs are not bigger, but that's a thing that's, it's fine. At the end of the day, it's like, okay, I'm an A cup, I'm going to own it.
Wait, so speaking of boobs, in your book, when people took the pretty, I noticed they got bigger boobs, they got longer hair, they got better skin. When you were writing your book, which is fiction, so it's different, did you find yourself being like, I can't believe I'm writing this as the beauty standard still? Did you evolve what you think of as the beauty standard?
I think I wrote the book. I think when you, and any fiction novelists in the room would probably attest to this, like I think after you, or really anyone working on like a creative art piece, like afterwards, after all the dust has settled, you can sort of stand back and look at it and be like, oh, that's why I wrote this. Like, I get it now. And I think I wrote the regulars because I really wanted to address my own self-esteem issues. And at the beginning of the process, I wanted to write about beauty because I went through a couple of, you know, years in New York when I was single and really wanted to be in a relationship and felt I had friends and I had had a young adult novel come out, so I sort of, you know, was going okay in other areas, but I would sort of look in the mirror and see an ugly face, and it was this, I came to believe that I was like secretly really ugly and no one was like gonna ever tell me, and I would like cry into like Skype to my mother and be like, I'm so ugly, and she'd be there in Australia being like, you're not, darling, you're so beautiful, you know, as all of our mother's secrets are beautiful. And then I sort of like came out of that dark period and like looked back on it and was like, wow, that was really intense. Why did I feel that way? And if I felt that way, I, you know, I'm sure I'm not alone. So the book was really to kind of like really force myself to have some hard like conversations to get to a stage where I could look in the mirror and feel satisfied with the face I saw there, which I think is such a, it is a difficult journey to go through, and it is like a journey I think every like woman, you kind of have to, it's like on you, no one else can like help you get there. And a couple of things really changed. When I was writing the book, I stopped wearing makeup to work because I was writing the book in between working in like a sort of a vaguely corporate creative job at a premium cable company 4 days a week. And I'd like wear makeup in the morning, you know, I just like, you know, foundation, blush, mascara. Like it wasn't like a full show, but it wasn't nothing. And as I was writing it, I'm like, well, I didn't really like wearing it and I don't think anyone really cares. And I sort of spend all day like being like, oh no, I can't touch my face. Like, and I love rubbing my face and just like I'm always like wiping my eyes, and I'd be like, I can't be human. And I just was like, I think I'm just going to stop wearing it to work. And of course, nothing happened. Like no one even knew. And I was like, oh, that feels good, you know. And I think
when you wear makeup, do you ever wear makeup now? And if you do,
no,
why?
I don't.
Never.
No,
not right now.
I'm wearing it right now.
Okay.
Wake up like this.
So that's an interesting topic. When you do actually put it on now, what's the reason you're putting it on then?
Yeah, I really decided to wear it if I was like celebrating something, like rather than just wearing it as like a kind of part of the uniform.
Armor.
Yeah, it's like armor. I would be wearing it because, like, I'm excited to be here and I'm, like, you know, putting on, like, a nice outfit, or I'm, like, at a party I want to be at, rather than, like, I wouldn't wear it if I was, like, going to work or just going to the bank.
The office does not merit that. Yeah. Like, no, they don't need that.
They're lucky to have me there. Are you kidding?
And, Emily, what about you? Do you, A, wear makeup? And if you do, why do you wear it?
I'm wearing makeup now, and you should all consider yourselves special.
Special occasions only. Yeah.
No, I wear it if I'm going out to an event. If I'm on stage, I wear it. In my neighborhood, I do not wear it. If I'm going for coffee with an old friend, no way. If I'm going for coffee with someone I need to impress, or I want to impress, or they're new and I'm excited about them, then I wear it. But it's really...
Are you mad that you have to put it on
for
them?
No, I don't have to put it on. It's something I didn't wear makeup at all when I was young, at all. Like a chapstick before I went out. That was getting ready. And as I've gotten older, because I'm 42 now, I tend to wear a little bit more because my complexion is not what it was, and it just evens me out a bit. But I really...
So it's more of like a little corrective and a little confidence boost.
A little confidence boost. But, you know, I mean, it's really funny. We're talking about beauty standards, and I feel like when I'm out and about in the city and I'm riding on the subway, I look at people and I just think everyone is so beautiful. Like, everyone that I see is so lovely. you know, like the older women, the young men, the young queer girls, everybody's so beautiful to me. I just look at them and I'm like, they're so beautiful. And I was thinking about this and I was like, but why do I have this perfect standard for myself? And for everybody else, I'm like, I just see them and I like them. So
I think a lot of women do that.
Yeah, and that's what I was thinking, is that I think a lot of people feel that way when they look in the mirror, they see the flaws.
Yeah.
But someone else would see the strengths.
Right. And Autumn, you have firsthand experience with this. You interviewed hundreds of women for your book, Face Value. What did you find, like, the reason they put makeup on was? Was it one reason? Were there lots of reasons?
There were lots of reasons. And that was one of the more interesting things that emerged for me, because I've always worn makeup, but I was wearing it more to just conceal. Like, I would wear, like, literally concealer on my face or mascara to, like, correct the white tips of my lashes. And what I found in talking with women and in looking at academic research on this was that there's a zillion reasons why women wear makeup. But we primarily, like, women do wear it to conceal, and we wear it to enhance or to attract, you know, evolutionary biologists would have a field day with that. But the idea being, like, as I wrote the book, I got more and more entranced with the idea of wearing makeup for fun and for pleasure and for not attracting attention from men or whatever, but just almost like a butterfly. Like, I wanted to be more colorful. So I wear a lot more makeup
now.
Look
at the Olympics. You know? Like, we were just talking about this. I don't think they're putting makeup on to, like, hide anything. It's a celebratory thing. Phoebe, do you wear makeup every day? And if so, why?
No.
Just forget it.
No, I mean, my mom never really wore makeup. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, and I never really wore makeup. I want to say I think the first time I really wore makeup was my senior prom, and I went to the mall. And because my mom didn't know how to do makeup, so I had to go to, like, this, it's like this kiosk outside, like a Dillard's or whatever. And the woman did my makeup, and she... And I look at the pictures now, she, like, didn't have the right foundation. So it was like kind of like a weird,
a kabuki,
like, Casper-y ghost thing happening on my face. And I was like, this is what it's like to be black, okay? but my rule is, if it's over 80 degrees and I don't have a shoot, I do not wear makeup, because I'm a sweaty person. I don't have time for it. So I've been barefaced, like, all of August. It's been
phenomenal.
It's like
a purely logical decision.
It's,
I like
so
that.
Nice.
There's rules even.
Yeah, so it's really only for, like, if I have to be on camera or if I'm, like, going on a date, maybe, like, the first, like, 5 dates, I'll be like, all right. And after that, I'm like, this is me. It's fine.
I've actually met women that are married to people and still get up early to put
That's
on makeup.
That's crazy.
Isn't that crazy?
It doesn't
get
matter.
Up early to put
doesn't
on makeup.
It doesn't matter. And if he cares, he's a piece of garbage. It doesn't. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like, get a grip. Like, looks just don't matter. I just don't care.
Well, hopefully not to the person you're sleeping with.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, they do. You want to be attracted to the person, but that, like, presentational kind of, like, you have to, like, to expect your partner to look a specific way all the time, like, that's
crazy talk.
Crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. And you ladies that worked in fiction, that wrote fiction, when you were creating your characters, did you, like, pull out an ad from a magazine and be like, I'm going to just, like, how do you come up with a look for a girl when it's not you? It's not the way you feel about beauty or hair. Why don't you go ahead, Georgia?
With the regs, it was really important for me to have three different young women. They're all in their early 20s. And I definitely didn't want to have, like, three white characters. So there's Krista is Southeast Asian. I had, like, a Southeast Asian Australian roommate back in Australia, and she's modeled, don't tell her, just between us, modeled pretty heavily on that character in this book. She's Krista, and she's, like, Southeast Asian American. And Evie and Willow, who's Dutch American. And for their looks, like, in fiction, I think you really want to have, like, a light touch when describing how someone looks. Like, you sort of want it to feel like the narrator never actually told you how they look, but you have a very clear idea in your head. So in creating their looks, I mean, they all sort of, like, they all physically look different, and they all have different attitudes towards beauty and have different kind of takes on their self-esteem. It's really kind of my personality in a way, just sort of broken down into three different categories and sort of, like, heightened. So that's kind of how I like approach their sort of looks. And I wanted them to feel like people that they're from Brooklyn, you know, like I like writing in this book, it's people that are familiar to me, like my community and...
Your tribe.
Yeah, my tribe.
Emily, what about you? How do you describe your characters? How do you come up with their looks?
Well, the lead character in the book is, her name is Hazel, and she's a redhead, and I did that because a book about blondes raging out, I didn't want to play the blonde brunette dynamic, and so I thought, let's put her in the middle, right in the middle, so maybe she can be, you know, at risk for this blonde virus, or maybe not. And I also wanted to do that because, you know, red hair is very rare, and there are stereotypes around all kinds of hair types. And I wanted the book to explore not just hair color, but also how we identify with hair. So everyone is at risk for the virus eventually. Women of color who bleach their hair are at risk. Older women, suddenly people think they're at risk because they're silver-haired, because they're gray-haired, which is close to blonde.
We're screwed.
Yep, everybody's screwed. And it basically, you know, it becomes like this parable about discrimination against women in general, and also women and how we find power. For Hazel, I made her kind of a frumpy character. She's a grad student, and that's how she would describe herself. She narrates the book, so she describes herself as being slightly chubby with glasses and terrible, terrible hair. And it's interesting because... that's her perception. But at the same time, I think if you were to meet her, I don't know who she...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee and you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly.
When it comes to style and luxury, eBay gets it. They're making sure the things that you love are checked by experts. Not just any experts, specialized experts. Real people who love this stuff with real hands-on authentication experience.
So when you see that shiny blue checkmark that says Authenticity Guarantee, shop with confidence. Every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is verified authentic through a detailed inspection. That's how you know that eBay's got your back.
Because when you finally step into those sneakers, put on that watch, get your real gold glow up, swing that handbag over your shoulder, or step out in that streetwear, you'll realize that feeling is unlike any other.
With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Would be because I think there are a lot of people who would describe themselves that way who don't actually look that way.
It's what we talked about before, where we all are harsher to ourselves than we are to other women.
Yeah, but then there are other characters in the book too. Like there's Moira, who's her roommate, who's black, and there's another friend who's blonde and supposed to be stunningly beautiful, named Larissa, who's at risk for the virus. And sometimes what I do when I'm writing fictional characters, because as you were saying, you need to have a physical image. And yeah. So sometimes I do use physical images. I like to, I don't know, I feel kind of guilty admitting this, but I like to go on Facebook, and what I'll do is I'll click through to friends or acquaintances' photos and then look at their photos of their other friends that I don't know. And sometimes I'll pull up images and I'll use a face. Like, then I can have a face in front of me to write a character.
So there's someone on Facebook that is like a killer blonde that you are describing.
Well, actually, the killer blondes in the novel were inspired by a Gucci ad that ran in about 2009. And it was these four women in like safari wear and jungle wear. And they were very, very emaciated, as you know, sometimes models are. And they just look like they were ready to kill somebody. They look kind of vampiric.
Listen, I work at a fashion magazine. I feel like half of our photo shoots that we do are like women that are just like hate the world and want to kill someone. They never look happy to me. But it brings up a good point, which is sort of, you know, advertising and media, a lot of it is super retouched. Even those women were probably not as skinny as they were retouched to be. And, you know, it's become a political issue a bit. There's a bill in Congress right now, it hasn't been voted on, about retouching. Where do we want to have the Federal Trade Commission look at advertisements and see if they are retouched? And if they are, is that harming people? So I wanted to check in with you ladies, since you're sort of all about this world right now. Do you think it's okay that we retouch photos? And do you think there's any harm in that? Phoebe, do you want to go ahead?
I mean, I don't mind the occasional retouching.
Yeah.
It's fine. For my book cover, I was like, I saw the original shot and I was like, this is my face. I like this picture. I noticed that I have laugh lines because I tend to laugh a lot. So I was like, if we could just minimize that, that'd be great. But it wasn't like, I wasn't like, make my face thinner. I was like, I don't want to do that. Right. But just like,
clean it up a little bit,
I think it's fine. But I definitely do think, because they're like, I don't know, like on Instagram, people are like photoshopping pictures to be free. And like, it's fucking Instagram. It should just be like, you take a picture, you just throw it up, you put like a funny caption. But like, it's no longer just magazines. Like, people think they have to Photoshop their own pictures.
Right, because if you there's a bill and we're doing it for magazines, like, are you going to go on the Instagram feed of that girl that's everybody's friends here who you know face-tuned the shit out of her face?
Yeah, and you can't say anything to be like, great picture, and it's like, everyone knows the lie.
Like, but you don't look like that.
Yeah, you don't look like that, and you don't need to look like that. So yeah. I do think that, like, Photoshopping has kind of mutated into a thing that was just like a tweaks here and there to now something that's become aspirational. And I think people, especially who are younger and haven't grown up in a world where you like don't have to Photoshop your own personal pictures,
yeah,
they think that is like normal,
right?
And that's what they should do in order to be pretty, in order for guys to like them, in order for them to have friends. So that's the part where it's like, this is, it's gotten out of control, in my opinion.
And Autumn, when you were researching your book, you did a lot of research on what it means, like, scientifically, what women think about when they see these retouched images. What did you come away with thinking about this whole topic?
You know, it's interesting. I think that the Truth in Advertising bill, I'd like to see it pass, because I think that we as consumers should be aware when a product is being sold to us under Photoshopped guise. That said, I think that a lot of the talk about Photoshop is making us all hate ourselves is sort of overblown. I feel like, first of all, what it does, I feel like it can rob women of the agency to look at an image critically and be like, yeah, I know what's going on there. We do all know what's going on in images. That said, we also have a knee-jerk reaction to it, because images are very, you know, dear to our heart. What I found was that we've really, as a culture, have focused pretty strongly on the negative impact the images have had on us, idealized images. But in fact, we have a range of reactions to idealized images. We can have the comparison reaction, where we look at an ideal image and are like, oh gosh, I'll never look like that because she looks amazing and I look human. But you can also look at an image and have an identification response, where you look at an idealized image and feel more ideal yourself. And there have been studies that have shown this. And so it's interesting to me that I feel, you know, as a feminist, of course, I want images to help women's lives, not hurt them. But it's interesting that we've focused only on the ways in which images have harmed us, instead of the richer ways that we actually interact with them. And it's interesting to see how that plays out, how that does play out on our social media feeds. I remember, like, when social media was a new thing, like on Friendster, people didn't really know what picture.
You, yeah, you just Friendster.
I totally just dated myself. Friendster, yo. People didn't really know what pictures to post of themselves. So it was this weird thing.
Nobody
of like...
Nobody had a headshot
no,
back then. Everybody's
no.
got a headshot now.
Well, yeah. It's funny, though, because my first online profile, like, I put my senior picture on. Like,
your literal Facebook picture.
Exactly. And it's funny now, because I feel like now we know, if you post a picture that's too idealized of yourself, then you're going to, like, fall short when people meet you, and they're like, oh, you don't look like that. Yeah. So we've also had this response of, like, you have to really know what you look like to have like a successful social media presence. So.
And what about you, Georgia? Are you down with this bill? Do you think there needs to be regulation, or do you think
it's like, we all know what's going on.
I think the bill's a good idea. I think it's a good thing to give like something that's actionable. Like, there's a lot of talk right now about the anti-photoshopping movement, and I think we're all generally on the same page. But as apart from all of the personal growth that we can do around that, like, I think it's good to have something that is it seems like a progressive political step forward. I know it's a Republican that put it forward, which is so interesting. I'm like curious to see how it might play out, if it might just be another example of like men telling women what to do with their bodies. Like, it sort of could be a conservative sort of thing in the end, but yeah. Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see. I feel like what's important to me, and I think what, you know, is sort of part of my values as a creator, is rather than having like less photoshopped images of very beautiful women, just to create and have more diverse faces and bodies in the media and in pop culture. And mm-hmm. that's kind of, I think, a better like thing to like agitate for, and also to sort of like support, create, like if you're a creator, just to be kind of aware, and I'm you know, sure that that's something that we're already doing, but like to make sure that you're just like not putting forth a straight white cast. And
but when you say diversity, and maybe this will be one of our last questions, what is diverse these days? Because I know when they do diversity at a fashion magazine where I work, it's like skinny, pretty people, but there's a black one and an Indian and a white. You know, it's not diverse like you look out into real people and diversity. So have you, Phoebe, noticed a change in the way people are trying to be more inclusive, or do you still feel like diversity has a way to go? We're like barely there.
I mean, I feel like it's kind of gotten better.
What about when you're auditioning?
Oh, it's a dumpster fire still. It's still like, it's always like, I'm like the best friend. I'm never the love interest. It's either best friend or it's an assistant to like some like asshole white dude. I'm like, oh, Gary. And it's like, I'm like amused by him being like a jerk off. And that's it. I'm never the lead of my own story. Like my character.
Like
has
you could
no
be in the movie, but you're not going to be the
right.
Lead.
Like I don't have. There's no internal motivation. And you know, I've gotten to a place where like I tell my agents where I would be like, I'm not auditioning for this. This is garbage. Like I straight up would be like, this is offensive. I'm not going to perpetuate this. But I mean, I feel like what's gotten better is that there's technology, so it's like, you can just create your own web series, or you can like, you know, write your own books. I guess there's also like, well, you can always have write your own books, but I guess the point is that like, that's like not new. But you know, part of the reason why I got a book deal was because of my blog. So that's like technology. There we go. I figured it out. You can have a WordPress or whatever. But so basically there's a way for people who haven't seen themselves reflected to get their voices out. And in that way, there other people will gravitate towards that and be like, oh, there's value in that. Because I think a lot of times if you're not the standard, people go, there's no value in that. So you kind of have to prove it first. And then people will go, oh, I guess I'll give you a little. It's a little bit. It's not what I would give like the straight white dude. So I feel like things are slowly changing, but it's also like,
on us to keep them changing. Right. Like, make your own things so that it will keep changing.
Yeah, and we have to like bring other people along. Like I'm excited. Like for instance, Fresh Off the Boat is an amazing show. But it's like, that shouldn't be the only show that has Asian leads. Like, that's right. Insane
like,
to me.
Like, beware of tokenism. Right. But
and they've been very smart about, like, that show is not trying to represent the entire Asian experience. Right. It's like, it's very specific in a way that's also universal. Mm-hmm. So I think it's people just have to make it a priority to want to have diverse voices in comedy and literature and life and advertisement and beauty. And most people don't make it a priority because most people don't care. It feels great to say, I care and I want diversity, but it's a lot of work to actually do it, especially if that's not your instinct to care about other people who don't look like you.
And I think it's hard as well. Like, it does require you going outside of your own experience, and that's like definitely a tricky thing. Like I really want to have like a diverse range of characters, and you know, that means that you have to like like ask people and seek out that information, and that is more work. It's so easy to write something from your perspective. Like, I'm like a queer Australian, so I can write a million stories about like queer Australians, but like it's so much harder for me to sort of do the work of getting into other perspectives. But it's vital, and it's really, you have a responsibility to, I think, to do that. Absolutely. In this day and age.
You guys especially, as authors and creators, you're the ones that are going to be able to push this conversation forward. So I think we're about out of time for our panel part, but I know you guys probably have questions for our panelists. Anybody want to start out with a question?
I think that some of us are here because we are women creators, and this is less of a beauty question and more of like navigating in a world where you're like not necessarily using your beauty to like get in the door. Like I noticed that like LinkedIn is supposed to be this forum for like helping you acquire new opportunities for work, but I feel like it's become like this extension of like Facebook, and people are like sending their photos along with resumes because like now all of a sudden it's like people need to know what you look like before they hire you or look at your skill set. So I guess since all of you are in a successful place, like how have you like kind of not used your beauty to like ascend up the ranks?
Yeah, I think honestly you just have to self-create. That's like the only way. Like nobody was like, oh, we want to hear what Phoebe has to say. Like all of my stuff I just sort of like self-generate, and it led to like when Jess and I started our show, we were just doing it at UCB East as just because we had fun hanging out with each other, and then it turned into, I was like, hey, we should make it a podcast. And I was like, maybe we can just like tape it ourselves and just throw it up on iTunes. And she was like, well, maybe we can make it a little more professional, go like WNYC. And I was like, good point. But I was just really just, I think you just have to find out like what turns you on creatively and just make yourself the star of like your content. Because I mean, I think even when women are successful, there's like, Amy Schumer is like the female comedian right now, which is like cool, but there's like thousands of female comedians, but it gets reduced to like she's like the only one that could be on top right now. So I think you just really, if you self-create and just throw a lot of stuff out there, and a lot of things like may not be good. You know what I mean? Like garbage blog posts I've written where I've been like, that is terrible, I'm embarrassed, whatever. And you just create your own stuff because fuck LinkedIn. Can I say that? Is that okay? Like I'm wanting to, it's so dumb. Like it helps in a way, but I feel like doing your own stuff, you become your calling card, and you're going to, the people are going to gravitate towards you that have the same mind, like mind. Is that the word? I can't talk. I've been talking all day for work, so I'm like, bleh. But like attracts like. And so if you're doing stuff that you love, and people get you, those are going to be the people that you want to work with anyway. So like most of the work is done by you just doing what you want to do.
You know, don't play the game. Be genuine, I feel like is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Autumn.
Oh, thanks.
Autumn, you were saying?
Yeah, I'm going to jump in on the idea that you are your own calling card, because that's absolutely true. And this sort of goes back to the question, like as far as related to beauty. I sort of had to recognize that like, frankly, there is a sweet spot of like looking pretty enough, but not looking too pretty. Because like any woman who's ever, you know, I'm a writer, not a performer. If you're a woman who writes and your picture is out there in any way, people will critique you for either side. And so for me, it was a thing of like, okay, well, let's try to hit that sweet spot. You know, like don't look like you're trying too hard, which is just a mirror really of what I think I experienced just before I started writing at all. Like just women, how do you look like you are just naturally pretty, but not like you're striving to be pretty. And that's just, so it's just really like a magnifying glass on what I think women face already for myself.
Yeah, when I was first starting to write, I had a blurry author photo that my husband took in a grocery store. And then for my second novel, I said I don't want an author photo, period. So we didn't put one out with it. And I probably would have gotten more reviews if I'd had an author photo. And then...
Good tip.
Yeah. Now I live in New York. All of that was back in Toronto in the days before Facebook, when you could maybe get away with not having an author photo. Now I have author photos, and so The Blondes just came out, and I'm working on the next book, and I don't know when it will come out, soon, I think, but it's kind of a butchy book. Like, it's about men, and it's about prohibition, and it's tough, and my writing is actually quite hard, and then I look soft, and that sometimes confuses people. And so my husband said to me, go do a professional author shoot. And so I called up a friend who's a photographer. You know, it's not like I booked someone I didn't know. And I went to her house, and I had three different outfits, and we did a photo shoot. But I made sure that my tattoo was showing in all of them, because I was like, this is a hard-ass book. So the author photo
branding.
Has to...
Branding. It's all about branding.
It has to suit a little bit. And actually, I have to admit that I was much happier with the photos she took, because I feel like I look more like myself. Even though I changed outfits several times, I look much more like myself, and I feel like it suits the material. So to me, it's about suiting the material. But I mean, you know, before I didn't have great author photos, and I still managed to do okay, because I think people will take you seriously if you take yourself seriously and you put out good work.
Other questions for any of our panelists?
I think all of you are great, but who inspired you and, like, made you want to be where you are today?
Who wants to, Autumn's got one ready.
I will say unabashedly Naomi Wolf, who in the years since The Beauty Myth has sort of gone in a very different direction, but her book was incredibly important for women. I'm 40 years old, so for like Generation X women, was enormously important. Just the ideas that she was really one of the early prominent voices talking about how the ways that beauty was affecting us, and that was just crucial for me. So that's
Emily.
I have no idea.
Okay. I thought you were like, that's not true.
This no. No, I was sitting there befuddled, like going like, I don't know, my parents, you know.
Do you want to think? And what about you, Georgia?
Well, one like really important pop culture experience for me was Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Chosen One fans. Buffy was a show that came on when I was in maybe first year uni, like I was like 19 or 20.
Wait, is that high school or college?
College.
Okay.
And it was back when there was like 5 TV channels in Australia, and Buffy was on one of them. And it wasn't until I started watching Buffy that I realized that all the other shows that I watched and like enjoyed were like sexist, and they weren't inclusive. And like within pop culture, like I was a student activist, like a pretty political student activist, and I had very high standards for the company I kept, and I was always at a rally. Like if there was a spray painted t-shirt, I was wearing it. With, you know, a new kind of, like, demand every week. But then I would kind of watch Friends or Seinfeld and be like, oh, this is great. And when I watched Buffy, I was like, oh, this is a show about female power. And there are, gay, like, queer characters on it. Like, we all remember, hopefully we all remember Willow and Tara. And it was... And that really kind of made me realize, like, oh, that's kind of what I want to do. It's like, I want to make pop culture that is funny and entertaining, but has, like, a progressive set of values, and that isn't something that when I watch it, I'm just having to ignore the sexist parts, or, like, just sort of, like, ignore the parts that, like, are, you edit out stuff so much. And that was a show that was very, like, sort of meaningful for me.
What about you, Phoebe? Aww.
Mentors, pop culture that you've looked up to?
Yeah, I mean, so I didn't really listen to much stand-up until I started doing stand-up, because I got into it just on a whim because a friend wanted to take a stand-up class, so I took it with her. But like growing up, my show was Felicity, and I was like, this is going to be my life. I'm going to move to New York and wear chunky sweaters. And have two guys really be into that, and like that didn't happen. I was like, okay, cool. But there's, I find like inspiration in like all sorts of things, like music. Like I love going to concerts. Like that's like my church for me, where I feel like really inspired and I feel like really hopeful about humanity. But then there's all, you know, like I read.
Wait, what shows are we talking about?
What, literally,
U2?
Like obviously,
don't tell us U2.
Obviously U2, but like they're my favorite band. Don't judge me. I judge myself enough for it. But it's also like literally any concert. Like I went and I saw Erykah Badu for the first time like 3 weeks ago. She was like incredible.
So that was your first time?
My first time seeing her, yeah. And
that's like church. You get a good feeling.
So I get inspired by that. But then I read it, because my book is an essay collection. So I read like a lot of essay collections. And like someone like Mindy Kaling, like I think she's so funny and hilarious. And she's her own boss. And so I really gravitate towards that. So yeah, just a lot of women inspire me.
I'm going to take away Erica Badu and Felicity, if that's okay with you.
Okay, sure, do it. Make a share. Yeah.
Yes, question back there.
Good evening, everybody. I consider myself a social media observer on all major channels, and what I'm seeing now is the rise of the young teenage early 20-something social media influencer who has millions of followers and they're being paid to tweet about these products and these clothing lines. And it's so problematic because on the one hand, social media has democratized how we project ourselves to the world, but on the other hand, it's created this temple, like the Oracle of Delphi, of youth. Mm-hmm. And you're not necessarily seeing women over 40 with the million followers or the million-dollar book deals or the clothing lines or the makeup lines. And I wanted to know, what was your take on that?
None of us have a million followers.
Yeah, we're all in trouble.
I'm just going to put it out there. I feel like because we all have one of these now, that is part of, it's a problem, but it's also a great thing. But someone was talking about why they wear makeup, and it's because someone's going to take a photo of me at any moment and any time, because you can't get away from cameras at this point. So I do think part of, if you're using social media as your lens for that, you are going to come away with a thought like you have, because it is very narrow focused. But if you look around this room and you look at the authors of the books on the shelves and don't just look at social media, I feel like you're going to have a more positive view of it. Do any of you guys have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I also feel like that doesn't last. Like, that's not... like, those people aren't necessarily going to have careers. Like, there's a difference between, like, being popular and having 4 million followers, and then, like, what are they going to do when they're 45?
I always think that, too.
What is your skill set?
They're going to face-tune the shit out of it. Yeah.
It's like, what are your skills? What are you going to contribute actually to the planet and to, like, whatever industry that you're in? So, like, I just think, like, yeah, it sucks that, like, certain things are popular when there are things that maybe have you feel like are better quality that aren't popular, but popularity fades. Like, to me, it sucks in the short term, but in the long term, it like doesn't, I don't know, it just doesn't matter to me as much.
So I feel like we need to come back in 10 years. You guys will all have written another book,
yeah.
And we will reassess the state of beauty. This was such a great panel. You guys are awesome, such smart women. Thank you for your books. Thanks for coming here tonight.
Thank you. You did an amazing job moderating. Yeah, you killed it.
Great work, Jen.
You mentioned a lot of products and people and places and brands and things in this episode, so I just want to put it out there. If you want to find out where any of those things are, go to fatmascara.com.
And you can also follow us on Instagram and Twitter and at fatmascara for both of those things. And you can also contact us directly by emailing us at info@fatmascara.com.
So profesh.
So profesh. Thanks for listening, guys.